Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water, straight from your kitchen tap. Today is another special.
Woohoo!
Today's conversation is with...
I'm Paul Chowdhury, and I'm a stand-up comedian, ready to do this podcast.
Yeah, I really like Paul. I've met him a couple of times now, and I ended up watching his special after the last time I interviewed him, which we'll discuss in the podcast. And I really loved it. It's on Amazon Prime, and it's called Live In It. And Paul's kind of an interesting character. He's not like all the other stand-ups, is he? He's kind of, well, I suppose a lot of the comics are very different. That's what makes them, special. Paul's funny, and his delivery, I really like his delivery, deadpan, and then every now and then just comes out with a classic line. Nice, friendly interview, wasn't it?
Yes, he was a lovely chap. Really enjoyed his company, yeah.
Okay, let's hear him. This is Paul Chowdhury.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Paul, thank you for doing my podcast. Welcome to the kitchen. I buy all my guests presents. I've been going to the health shop recently looking for presents. I like sustainable gifts and stuff, but I saw this. It stuck out and I thought, this is what I've got to get you. It's you and oil. Nourish and invigorate men's hair and beard. Perfect for you with your lovely beard.
You know
beard.
What, Tim? Thinking of a gift for me, I don't think you could have done better than that.
It says on the back, and this is what I like about it, because this is the bullshit which sells it. Nourishing relationship. The skin is the surface of my personal planet. It connects me to the world. I want this relationship to be sustainable and vibrant, and I see that you and oil understands it, but by combining natural and essential oils with bioactive elements. There you go. So,
man, that is a gift I'm going to use as well. Thanks for that, Tim.
I think you'll like that.
I like that. And it's all natural, very well packaged. And they sponsor the podcast.
Not yet, but hopefully they will. If it's a good product. So how are you feeling today? Are you well?
Yeah, good to see you, man. You know, it's good to be back in the country.
Yeah, last time I saw you, I interviewed you for the Movember podcast.
Yeah.
And I feel bad about it. And I'll tell you why, because I know, obviously, of you and your work. I've interviewed you on Sunday Brunch as well. But I hadn't watched your specials, which had just happened on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but during that interview, I suddenly got this real guilt complex. I kind of not sure I was aware of it, if I'm really honest with you. Anyway, I went home and watched it. And I've got to say, it's exceptional.
Oh, thanks for that, mate.
It's really, really, appreciate really good. That. And it's, and I had to text you straight afterwards saying, mate, this is a brilliant. And the reason why it's brilliant is it's like an American special.
Yeah.
Very much like you don't take any prisoners, do you? You just go for it.
Try and be. So you go. I thought the producer was jumping in saying, hang on a second. Mate. I've seen it. It's absolute. Is it got to keep it clean here? Or?
No.
We can say anything.
Yeah, you say whatever you want.
It's not like Sunday brunch today.
No, it's not like Sunday brunch.
This is Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, Wednesday afternoon in the kitchen. Yeah, no, it's like an American. It's like an American special because it's, you know, you're not scared.
Am I scared? That's the question. Am I not scared? I think what I've tried to get out of my stand-up is be as truthful and as honest as possible. So that's kind of how I see things in my life, but your perception of that is slightly different to where I see it. But then people say, hang on, you're fearless, but I'm just saying what I see.
I was shocked. And the reason why I'm shocked is I watch so many British stand-ups and I love all the American guys and stuff. I watch so many British ones and they seem to be safe now. Everyone seems to be doing it in a safe way. Yours just wasn't safe at all. You just took apart everyone. You went for Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, white people. You just went for it all. And you said, look, I don't mind if I want to offend everyone. And you just went for it.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is really, really interesting stuff.
If you're going to offend people, be an equal opportunity. Don't discriminate and not offend a certain sector of people. Otherwise, you are discriminating against a certain section of the community. So I think you should be able to joke about anything. You should be able to love anything. So why shouldn't you be able to joke about anything? And it's not coming from a place of malice, for instance. But people think, oh, you're joking, but you must hate that person. Not necessarily. You're not inciting hatred towards a group of people. You're doing jokes about things you experience in life. So if I meet as a cross-section of the community and I do a joke about them, doesn't mean I'm singling out anyone. So that's how I see life. Comedy is about life. So why should you exclude? I remember when I used to do the clubs, right? And a comic would come backstage and go, oh, I can't do that disabled joke tonight, or that joke about a black person tonight or something. I'm like, why not? So, well, there's a disabled person in the front row. Well, then it's offensive to that group of people. You should be able to do that joke to that group of people. And if it's not offensive, they'll be fine with it.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I was listening to Andrew Doyle, who's a comic. He was on a podcast recently, an American podcast, and Joe Rogan podcast, actually. And he was saying that over here that we've become really PC. And I'm not sure that's the word, but he said that he was talking to a comedian who said that at the end of every gig, they like to tell the other comedians the jokes they're not supposed to be using.
Right.
And I'm like, well, when did that happen? And he said he couldn't believe it when he went to America, because in the American clubs, they're hammering everyone. Right. And Joe Rogan said that the comedy clubs are where it's supposed to be at for pushing back on everybody else's opinions. Do you find that over here, that that's happening?
Well, the club circuit is slightly different to the touring circuit. So when you go to I go to clubs now to just try out stuff. I'm going to get worked into a show, and they're not going to know you're on. So when you do a one-man show and I do 2 hours to my audience, they're expecting to be in my company. Whereas when you go to a comedy club, they're there for the material, not necessarily to be in your company, because you get a 20-minute set or a half-hour set. So they're there for the jokes, the material. So they don't tend to... It's hard to sell your persona as hard in a short set as it is in a long set. You're spending time in someone's company. This is like listening to a quick interview on the radio, you know, in between two songs, rather than a podcast where we can now understand what level we're on. We're in each other's company, rather than I'm just going to come up here and tell you, plug an Amazon special, for instance. So when we're in the Sunday brunch, I'm out there for 5 minutes and we're going to have a quick chat on off. But now you actually get to experience, and when even the Movember podcast, I felt as if I got to know you more as a person rather than that quick on and off thing. So it's probably more of an analogy for comedy clubs compared to theatre shows.
Mm. Do you get any complaints about your material? Because you say all the way through the special, you go, yeah, everyone's complaining about me. But are they really?
The thing about comedy is people do, I think not just comedy, but people do take offence to a lot of things. And I could defend every single line of that show for what I said. In a way where it wasn't offensive, if necessary. But I think then you lose the joke. If you have to explain a joke, you've lost the joke.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would never do that. But it's something, you know, a critical backlash you receive. You know, people do. But if you look at the stuff I said in the show, without spoiling some of the topics in it, I came from a point of truth, and that's what I want to get to. Hopefully, by the end of my career, is I'm as honest. It's hard to be honest in life. Never mind. On stage, and being honest with a group, a room full of strangers, is even more difficult than doing it in private. So what you're doing is they're really exposing yourself. But for some reason, I find it easier to be more honest on stage than off stage.
Yeah. Excuse me, I'm quite clumsy when it comes to religion. I don't have a religion. But when you're in there and you're sort of like doing jokes about Muslims, or you're Sikh, aren't you? Yeah. And jokes about Hindus and everything. Is there more pressure on that? The Sikhs versus Muslims, etc.
Well, it's more about the community element rather than the religious part of the people you're talking about. So I'm talking about, you know, Sikh names or Muslim names,
yeah.
or is rather than picking apart holy books or something. That's not really what I do, but people think, oh, you're making fun of a religion. It's more about the cultural element of growing up being a Punjabi, which Muslims also can be, and it's an upbringing that's slightly different to, say, the way Dave grew up. So I talk about the differences, and at the same time, being brought up in England, I experienced both sides of it. So you've got a very niche and particular look on life, growing up through in dual almost nationalities.
I love the bit where you, I watched a bit of it again last night, where you got Dave, who's your British guy, and Dave's saying, why can't we do your accent? And then starts doing like a cliche Indian accent rather than your accent, which is Edgware.
I mean, that's all true. It's all true story.
Is it? That's brilliant.
You know, I get that. It's exactly what, you know, Tim says is, I'd get people coming up to me saying, I can't. Like, it came from, I did a deep, my first was called What's Happening White People, the first special I did, which was on Channel 4 about four or five times. I did that back in 2012, and people were outraged by the title of that. So that came about when I used to perform at clubs in the early 2000s, late 90s. I'd be the only non-white person in the room, and I'd say, What's Happening White People, which would get a laugh. That's all. It wasn't an attack on white people. No, I'm like, how come you can go up and say, what's happening, white people? Hey, it's racist, mate. No, it's not. And then I do a whole segment on it, and that's a big routine. It's like a 5-6 minute bit, I think.
Yeah.
About how, yeah, how come I can't say what's happening? Like, and how come you can do my accent? It's not racist, but I do a... And then you do. Yeah.
But what I love about it, honestly, this is what I love about it, is there's just like there's no bit where, like, as a white British person, there's no bit of it which I find remotely offensive. You're just telling the truth about everything. And you're hammering yourself whilst hammering Dave, whilst hammering, I don't know, all the different names you use and all different. And it's just, I just thought it's brilliant. It's really, I laugh so much through it. It's great.
Thanks, man. I mean, that's the point. It really is, people laugh. But
well, it worked.
But the whole point of that routine was, people are only offended by material when it's about them, or if it's if they're affected by it. Otherwise, no one cares about your comedy. Wait a minute. You were fine with the jokes about terrorism, but now I'm doing your accent, you're offended.
Yeah.
So if you're going to be offended by everything, or shut up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Either be, you can't just be, I'm talking about, I remember this woman came up to me after a gig once, right? And I was doing trying out material for this Channel 4 comedy gala at the O2 Arena. I was running a set in. I did this whole routine about staffies. So there's a certain type of person that owns a staff.
Yeah.
You know, got a staffie, you might, you know. But you never see the queen with a staffie, for instance. And then she came up to me. She goes, I just wonder, can I have a word with you? I said, sure, yeah, no problem. I was really, the stuff you did about staffies, you're going to go and do this material on TV and you're really giving staffies a bad name and it's really out of order because they've got bad press as it is, and what you've done about staffies is really out. So hang on a second. Firstly, it wasn't about it's about the owners, and secondly, I'm talking about a breed that's a, what about all the material I did about Asian people? And oh, that was fine. No, then that's fine. I'm not talking about them. She was more offended.
By the dogs.
You can talk about the darkies. Just don't talk about the staffies. Well, that's fine then, isn't it?
Does it feel like what you're doing is edgy, though?
When I get the criticism in return, then, yeah, I feel, hang on a second, I've crossed the line. And when I don't get invited on certain shows, how come I'm not allowed on, you know, the one show? It hurts me that I'm not allowed on the one show to promote a show, but certain people are. They probably have Bill Cosby on that show when he was around, but I'm not allowed on the one show.
Yeah, it's funny.
You don't see me on many shows.
No, well, I was going to say that. Why don't you do too many shows? Well,
they don't ask. So it's like, how come?
That's really weird because you're a shoo-in because you're obviously diversity, and that's what everyone's crying out for. So you're an absolute shoo-in to go on every single show. So why isn't it they're not phoning you up constantly?
Well, I was diversity before diversity was fashionable. Now it's fashionable. I'm the pre-fashionable diversity.
And your material is not good enough. It's not PC enough.
When I was doing diversity, it was before there was diversity in the industry. So when I was doing What's Happening White People, people were offended by the... Now the people, you'll see certain comics, I'm not going to name them, but they'll do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is so diverse. Oh, they have a voice now. It's amazing.
Yeah.
When I was, come, he can do us, and we can't. That's what I went through for them to now be able to present shows on TV and get projects off the ground and end up on the one show.
Were you one of the first then, do you think? I was
the first ever Indian to appear on Live at the Apollo.
Were you?
Yeah, okay. So I think like Omid had done it before, who's Iranian, and Shappy, Stephen K. Amos, you know, people like that. But well, Indian-wise, or as they call Asian these days, yeah, I was probably one of the first, actually, and then opened up the floodgates to what you see now on TV. I don't know if I was the person that opened up the floodgates, but the diversity became a thing after that. You know, I was the first person to have a Amazon special in this country, and What's Happening White People in 2012 with Universal Pictures ended up on Channel 4. I used to present Stand Up for the Week on Channel 4.
Yeah.
And there'd never been like an Indian or a non-white presenter on a mainstream stand-up show or even a mainstream show at that time. So, you know, certain comics did speak about that.
Why wasn't that? Was that because there weren't any Indian comics?
I think there are a lot of Indian comics, but just a lot of them even gave up. I'm not just saying that was Indian comics, but I think breaking through as a comic in general is a tough thing. But it didn't help, even for female comics now, you see. Even clubs now make it a policy to have a female act on a club bill, never mind TV. You know, I'd play Top Secret Comedy Club in Covent Garden, try new stuff, and Mark Rothman, the booker, make sure he'll try and get a diverse bill on that because it reflects what people see live, kind of reflects hopefully what they'll see on TV. But TV doesn't really reflect what you see in society. So I think what they're trying to do is now catch up with society.
But what's it like, though? Again, cliche, a little bit clumsy, but what's it like being an Indian growing up, wanting to do comedy? Are you, does the community like you doing it?
I've never really asked the community. So.
Because the Indian community, you always hear about, and you've sort of alluded to it at the beginning, that it seems that the Indian community is very tight always. Yeah. I don't know.
Hey, community, come here. I got a big announcement to make. I don't think that's ever been a thing. Hey, Paul Charity, you want to become stand-up comedian. All community, you must hear this.
The elders have to sit down and make a decision whether
you want to do stand-up?
Yeah, I want to become a stand-up.
Okay. Community, are you okay with this?
I don't think that would.
As long as you're okay with the community, I'll fly that flag for you all. Like Superman when he came back from the planet Krypton. Generally. And he came back and I'm the spokesperson for the community now. Super comedian.
But your audience on the special, your audience, obviously a lot of Indian people in your audience.
So. Yeah, that was interesting. That was filmed in Hackney. So it's quite a diverse crowd there. And also, without boasting, my tickets tend to sell out quite quickly. I took a massive gripe against Viagogo. I remember when my 2017, well, this was actually starting end of 2017, and the tickets were 20. What I do is like to keep my tickets quite affordable, so even scum can come and watch me. So even if they're on the dole, they can still afford a ticket. So the tickets were like 20 quid, and then Viagogo would buy tickets at 20 quid and sell them at £450 each, which would really upset me, because there'd be two people in the front row paying 900 quid for two tickets. And I was thinking, they're making more money out of this gig than I am. Viagogo. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, why don't you just come to me? I would have sold you a ticket at 500 quid and signed it for you rather than you paid 500 quid to Viagogo. So, and I do a whole routine on it. I said, how much did you pay at the back of the room? 20 quid. How much did you pay at the front? 400 quid. So, do you see the difference between your ticket at the front and that 20 quid ticket at the back is
I get to call you a bastard to your face. I get to rip you a new arsehole, whereas they paid 20 quid, and I ain't going to say shit about them. You dumb bastard. Why would you pay 400 quid for a ticket? I really find it quite offensive. And I don't get offended by anything until Viagogo. And now everyone's taking, and then all of a sudden, the other guy, the ginger singer, started taking a pop at them.
Ed Sheeran.
Yeah. And then other comics came out and got upset. But at that time, everyone thought Viagogo were real.
So then is it annoying for you? If you're selling out these shows quickly, sold out Wembley. That must have been a hell of a gig. Jesus.
The most impressive thing about that was it was a Wednesday. Rather than selling it out, because most people, you get a weekend show.
Yeah,
and
it's
an easier sell. But I thought, oh man, this is a Wednesday night. Who's going to come out on a Wednesday? It's a school night, and they're going to come out on a Wednesday, and it was in mid-November, so not an easy sell.
Yeah.
So I was offered, a couple of arenas, and Wembley wanted me more, or I don't know, maybe the other guys wanted me more. So I went with Wembley and sold it out. It was and did 5 Apollos at the time on that tour as well in London. So I'd kind of eaten up a lot of the London audience. Watford Coliseums and around the outskirts, Essex and all that. So I was thinking, there's another 10,000 tickets. This is not going to be easy, but he managed to do it.
That's amazing. So doesn't that annoy you when the TV lot are not then bending over
backwards year,
to put you on?
Yeah, that year in Wembley, there were 3 acts comics that sold out Wembley. It was Mickey Flanagan, Jack Whitehall and myself. And I'm the only one out of those 3 that can go to Sainsbury's unrecognised, which is quite a nice thing. I could go and buy this beard oil and they wouldn't even say,
oh my God, you're Paul Chadwick.
Whereas Jack Whitehall or Mickey did that. They wouldn't be able to go and they'd have to send someone in to buy this beard oil. They could buy a crate of it, but I'd only be able to buy 1 bottle.
You're mates with some of the American guys as well, aren't you? I was just telling Mark before you came here, I'm very impressed you're mates with Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
I love Dave Chappelle. He's great. And again, he does material like you as well. The difference between you and Dave Chappelle is you hammer your audience as well, who are actually paying to watch you. He doesn't do that so much. But how did you end up hanging out with those guys?
Chappelle, I met a few years ago when he first came to London. I think he was doing the Apollo as well, and then we end up going to a party together. He got a big entourage, so you end up in this entourage. And then I went to see him in Carnegie Hall in New York. Brad Pitt was at that show as well. Bruce Willis, DJ Khaled was next to me because you've got to turn all your phones. They take your phones off you, but DJ Khaled managed to get his phone in. And he was on his phone. And if they see you just on your phone, they'll come up to you and say, hey man, I'm DJ Khaled. So that's his thing. If you know who this guy DJ Khaled is.
Yeah.
And his defense of using his phone was, he's DJ Khaled. I'm DJ Khaled. I should be able to allow you. And then, it was a big, he's such a legend now in the comedy world. Chris Rock was on that show as well.
Oh, wow. Jesus.
Yeah, so it was a big bill. It was one of the big ones of that run. I ended up going to a club with him after
Was Chris Rock supporting Dave?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, there was a bunch of comics.
Oh, okay, right.
Arsenio Hall was also on that show.
Oh, okay, that's big, right.
Yeah, so it was like quite a celebratory show.
Right.
Whereas Chris Rock will jump on. He was trying out stuff for his special, so he was doing a shorter set, and then Chappelle closed it. So it was quite a long night. And then we ended up going to a club after that. And then when it's been in London, and then he did a documentary he filmed, because I know his producer who does all his specials, because I was going to do a show called Deaf Comedy Jam in America years ago. So his producer kind of asked me to come out there, and I did a lot of black shows. I used to do a lot of black shows in England, and then I ended up doing the black shows. It's called Chocolate Sundays at the Laugh Factory.
Right.
That's the name of the night. So it's a black show. It's called Chocolate Sundays. And the talk was getting me on this show, Deaf Comedy Jam, but it never got recommissioned in the end. And that's kind of the platform at the time for Black and Martin Lawrence. And then I ended up at a comedy store I did in LA. And Martin Lawrence was there actually at the gig. I remember they put all the support acts on at the beginning of the show. In England, you put like a an open spot on, like a new act on in the middle. You know, that's a baby position for them. It's easy. Whereas in America, they'll put you in at the beginning while they're still being set at their seats. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to do a set and Martin Lawrence is being taken to his seat. Stan Latham is his name. He started off the company with Russell Simmons and they did Def Comedy Jam. So Stan Latham's a good friend of mine. And then
have you seen Hip Hop Evolution, by the way, on Netflix?
I need to see that. Yeah.
Russell Simmons, like the guy, just changed hip hop music.
Yeah, he changed it with Def Jam. Yeah,
yeah, Run DMC. He said he started at the time. All the rappers were wearing like leather, and they were wearing what do you call those things? Cod pieces and eye patches and stuff like that. And he got Run DMC, and they started by wearing all that stuff, and then he just went to them, just wear what you wear, and you know, trainers and stuff. And there's a great bit where they're doing Talking Heads, and all the other rappers are going, and then Run DMC turn up on telly, and they were wearing tracksuits. They were wearing the stuff we wore to the gigs.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh no, man, we need to do some of this. And Russell Simmons was a visionary with all that
stuff. Russell Simmons, then he started off Def Comedy Jam. So it was Def Jam, Def Comedy with Stan Latham. So in a way, he kind of revolutionized stand-up to a certain degree in America because black performers thought they weren't getting bookings in the mainstream.
Right.
So a lot of the black comics, like Chris Rock or Chappelle, would do the black circuit. But in America, you could break through on the black circuit and become a multimillionaire just to playing to black audiences. Whereas in this country, you'll see a lot of black comics and they'll play the black circuit. It's not a big enough circuit in England.
Right.
So you'd have to become mainstream. But that wasn't happening years ago. You weren't seeing diversity on TV. It's only a new thing, really, if you think about it, having their own show. Or there has never been a Def Comedy Jam type show in this country.
Yeah.
It was a HBO show at the time, so that was even cable in America.
So have you ever thought about relocating to the States?
After this conversation, I'm thinking about it. This has really made me reevaluate my career. Are you thinking about getting out, mate? And
Have you ever thought about going clean, having your act totally clean so you can I don't think you should, by the way, because your act's brilliant. It's so refreshing seeing your Amazon thing, but because you can just know you're going to get the one show if you're clean.
Well, the second DVD I did, PC's World, was clean. I didn't swear in it.
Oh.
I think I went out purposely to try and do a clean tour show in a DVD.
Mm.
And I thought it's going to get me on the one show. I didn't get on the one show. But then I did routines which were, talking about the title of the show wouldn't get me on the one show.
Right.
Like PC's World. PC's World, my initial is PC.
Yeah.
So the routine I did on it was Paul Chowdhury, PC, PC's World, not as in PC World.
Yeah.
And the first time I decided to call the show PC's World, I did a show, I think it was in Essex, and I said to the audience, I'm going to call my show PC's World. And the guy shouted out, don't call it PC's World, call it Curry's. So now that's a joke on PC's World. Now, if you're listening in America, curry is a dish from the Asian subcontinent, whereas PC World is an electronic shop. So that doesn't make sense outside of England, really, does it? So now that's quite a funny joke on the world PC in curries. But then oh my God, it's really offensive, isn't it? No, but it happened to me.
Yeah.
So now when you talk about the truth, so should I not talk about the truth and talk about, you know, hoovering up my house and the problem with Mr. Sheen or something? I think maybe I'll start doing safer material instead of talking about the Michael Jackson documentary.
Well, actually, I was going to say, but what I love about your swearing is it's because you're so deadpan on the thing, and then every now and then you just insult a member of the audience with a swear word or something. It's just really funny because it's like it just comes from nowhere.
But not just in English. I'll swear in several different languages, so I don't discriminate.
Yeah, Chappelle gets in a load of trouble for the Michael Jackson thing, right? Well, he gets in a load of trouble for all his act, actually. Mm. People hated that act. Mm. I thought it was really funny, personally. I like it. You've also done your own take on Michael Jackson on your Live In It special. I love your take because it's the one that I don't know whether we should give it away. Yeah, I think we should. You know, that an Asian family would never let a kid go with Michael Jackson anyway. And I haven't always thought that. Since watching your special, I've thought, he's got such a great point. What the hell are these kids doing with him anyway?
Well, I spoke to Chappelle about his take on it and my take on it, because I went to see him just before he recorded his special, and I said, you know, I've got a completely different take on this to you on this. But he was kind of mates with Michael Jackson.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that feel as if it's a big conspiracy, even the Cosby thing. There were a lot of, I remember when I did a tweet on Jimmy Savile when it first came out, and this woman sent, this girl, I don't know if it was a woman, had a massive go at me saying, he's a family friend, how dare you? These are false accusations. You should really delete this tweet and your account and stuff like that. And then I looked a week later and she deleted her account. So even the whole thing about, there is a conspiracy that certain, the R. Kelly thing I did a big piece on,
yeah,
which also Chappelle did, but I was told by my lawyers I couldn't do it because he's not ever been found guilty. So the lawyers in this country didn't want to put that. And that Jackson routine was cut in different ways on different in different territories for the Amazon show because I couldn't say certain things. Because in England, you can't defame the dead, whereas in other countries you can.
Right.
You can defame the dead in Germany. So it'd be, because he wasn't found guilty, I could get sued in Germany for that routine. So certain bits of the material had to be cut out there.
Yeah. Is the comedian's role, though, is to push back on everything, isn't it? Otherwise, we can't have the comedians towing the line. We need the comics to, they're the ones who are going to mock anything, whether it be Trump or diversity or whatever. It's up to the comics to keep pushing back on everything.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that their job?
You know, I think comedy is so wide, isn't it? It's like, what's life? Comedy is life, really. So it's actually, I find it funnier to see a comic even defending Trump these days rather than taking the approach of, because if you go out on stage and say Trump's a wanker, you'll get a round of applause. And yeah, it's kind of the easy take on it. If you defend certain things Trump says, that's probably going the polar opposite and thinking, oh, hang on a second, this guy's good, and keeping it funny. Even though I don't agree with what Chappelle said in that routine, if you manage to keep it funny, that's kind of the point of it. I don't have to agree with everything the comic says.
Yeah, and you're not insulted by Chappelle either by saying it, right?
I think he's got the right to his opinion on it.
Or offended.
I don't respect his opinion on
yeah.
it, but I respect his right to have his opinion on it and keep it funny.
It's funny, we had on Sunday Brunch the other day, we had Alexis Sale, and he's right at the beginning of the comedy movement. And it, what's interesting is I can't remember if this was on air or off air. I was having a chat with him about it, saying how it was the new rock and roll. Before that, it was literally guys in nightclubs going, I'm not saying my mother-in-law's fat. And
yeah.
It was that type of humour. These guys came along and started. So it's pretty modern. I mean, what's the word I'm looking for where you take the mickey out of politics and stuff?
Satire.
Satire's been around forever, but usually in print and stuff like that. For actual comics to come up on stage and start hammering that home, like Ben Elton did, and Alexis Sale and Joe Brown, all those people who came along, it was a newish thing, wasn't it? Now we seem to have fallen back towards the old, you know, let's not offend anyone because we might get some work.
Whereas it was punk, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Whereas you've stayed down that line of like, well, okay, I'm not going to get the one show, but I'm going to get laughed off my audience.
I'm not going to get the one show, but I'm going to sell out Wembley.
Yeah.
So what's it going to be?
So, it's not bad.
And the last time, I did get offered the one show once, actually. This is, they asked me to kind of turn it into routine. It was to come on and talk about Ramadan. So they asked me to come and talk about Ramadan. Can you come and speak about, you know, your religious ceremony of Ramadan? And I said, well, I can, but I'm not a Muslim. So that was, and then I ended up getting Tez Ilyas on the show because he was a Muslim. No one had heard of Tez, but they put him on there because he was a Muslim talking about Ramadan, not because, and then, you know, it kind of kickstarted his career at the time.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, well, it's a bit weird that you just are, why not ask me to come and talk about, you know, hurricane. what was the last hurricane? There's a new one coming this weekend, so
yeah,
whatever the hurricane was at the time. But they won't. They'll ask me to come and talk about something, or Diwali or something.
Yeah.
But now it's slightly changed. But you know, why am I only asked to come and talk about those things, or my take on the Shamima Begum case? But I'm not on the one show. We never asked that. As far as they're concerned, it never happened.
Yeah.
So.
You also had Bill Burr support you, didn't you? Which is, Bill's huge.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he supported me, but...
Let's say it.
But he actually ended up, in a way, I used to perform at this golf club in Ruislip. When I used to do the clubs, I'd get a 20-minute set. But at this golf club, it was called the Comedy Bunker. And they used to do like longer, so you could do an hour there. So outside of the club circuit, you couldn't do a longer set. And I'd find it quite frustrating where I couldn't develop my skills as a longer performer. And then I'd pick up a bit of an audience, they'd come and see me there. And Bill Burr was doing his first ever run at Leicester Square Theatre. And my mate reached out to him, or the booker at the time, and said, can you come and play? We'll give you some stage time. You can just try. And he jumped on the show I was on and performed to my audience. And he did half an hour off the top and I did an hour at the end. So, and that kind of became mates with him there.
I love the idea that Bill Burr's playing Ruislip Golf Club. Yeah. Yeah. He's so big now. Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, no one knew who he was then. And it was half full, Leicester Square. He did two shows, I think, the next night or the next two nights. And it was barely full. It was about 200 people.
Now he sells out, doesn't he, everywhere?
Like, well, yeah, he's doing
Royal Albert Hall. He did his special, wasn't
he? He's humongous now. Yeah.
What was he like?
Really good guy, actually. Yeah, good guy. He's had a bit of backlash recently, hasn't he?
What about?
I think there was he said something about, there was a sexist thing that went on, and I can't go into too much detail because I'm not going to do this justice, but let me find out what exactly happened. But it was something he said on his podcast, because he uses his podcast to try out ideas, which is great as a comic, which is why I want to get my thing started. I'm going to start a podcast where you can develop ideas. But you can never know if it's... See, the thing about performing to a live audience is you get an immediate reaction, response to it. Mm. I don't know if anyone's found any of this offensive or disagree with anything I've said, but you'll never know until you get a tweet. And then at the same time, tweets, if you say something on TV people disagree with, you'll get like 50 tweets or something. And you feel like everyone's ganging up on you. But they're not. These are just 50 individual people. They haven't all got together.
Yeah, the difference is, though, why being a like Bill Burr, Chappelle, you, Rogan, whoever, the great thing about your careers is you're autonomous. You say something because you're not tied into a TV company. You say something and I don't like it, and I tweet you, I don't like it. ITV, BBC, one show, whatever, they're not going to cancel you. And your audience, you're going to still sell out the arena or the Apollos or whatever, because your audience still want you. They don't care whether you've said something. And that's the great thing about being in your position. So you do a podcast and you say something offensive. It doesn't offend people. It doesn't matter, does it? That's the great thing about being a comic. Now, if you tie yourself in, like a lot of the British ones do, into a TV career... Mm. Then you're knackered because you can't go on stage and say something because you'll get cancelled.
Well, that's the kind of deal, I think, with if you're on a contract with, say, the BBC or something or ITV, you know, you've even got to orchestrate the way you say things. Even with Philip Schofield, it's really calculated approach, which I did some routines on the other day.
Did you?
Obviously, I won't go into them too deeply here because of certain reasons, and I don't want you to get sued. So the things you can and can't say, but the freedom on stage is very different to the freedom on, you know, that night I recorded 3 hours of material. Well, 3 hours of a show, so it was about 2 hours of material. So the first show I did about an hour and a half, the second show I did 2 hours, which was cut down to just over an hour. And it's very difficult to work out what to take out. And then there's, you know, the whole Shemima Begum thing, which has now come back into the media. That was all in there. But then you think the show had to be a global show, had to work in all around the world rather than just in England. If I was doing Philip Schofield material for my next special and it's broadcast in Malaysia, no one's going to know who Philip Schofield is.
Yeah.
Or if I talk about the one show, they wouldn't even know what I'm talking about.
Has the smartphone been the curse of the comedy club? Because... You know, you could just go and do whatever you want. It's word of mouth and everybody just says, oh, he said this really offensive joke or whatever. But no one really hears about it. Now they can video you doing it. You know, and you can, they can put you online.
Yeah, I mean, I had to rip someone a new arsehole on the weekend for doing that. I was talking about the attacks in Streatham, the terrorist attack.
Yeah.
I did a whole routine on it. But she, you know, I won't go into the whole routine, but then she just took her phone out and filmed a tiny bit of it. Which is, you know, if I'm just saying that beginning bit and you've taken out the punchline and it just looks like me standing in front of a room full of white people.
Yeah, so, that's terrible.
Just take out the you know, so I'm talking, so this terrorism attack in Stretford, and they just see that bit.
Yeah.
I think I'm in, you know, you can, everything can get taken well out of context, which is why watching a show like mine on Amazon, like the full show rather than an Apollo set or a short clip, you're buying into my world or the comics world and you're understanding his take on it rather than just the words. It's very clickbaity now. People hear a word and think I'm offended by just a word. I was talking about even, you know, the Madeleine McCann documentary in it. Even if you just mention Madeleine McCann now, people just kind of tighten up. But you should be able to discuss everything.
Is it nice when you get, like, you know, like Philip Schofield there, you've got something to work with. And as you say, you know, it's not going to go on a special because it's not going to translate. But you've got some new, you've got something there to work. Do you like going to the clubs and just eking it out, trying to find the joke, trying to find what's funny in that?
It's tough, man. You know, you can, that's the whole point. But when you do risky material, it's firstly doing, the most nerve-wracking thing about stand-up is doing a new routine because you just don't know how people are going to take to it. And even if you try it and you make, oh no, you shouldn't do that. Don't talk about that. Everyone will say that probably. Outside of comedy is like, don't talk. Because the comics want to, audiences want to see things that talk about, you talk about things they can't talk about. And you're saying it publicly. And you're saying it. So it's a release valve. It's a cathartic experience. I'm like, this guy's managed to turn this into something funny. He's talking about gender identity or non-binary, you're talking about such, there's so many things you can talk about which are considered taboo in this current age. And you don't have to be offensive. I got attacked by some guy online and I was talking about non-binary people and he said I was being transphobic. And non-binary people are not transgender. So people just pick up and they get the, understand what you, when you attack me, understand what you're attacking me about and understand the subject. Whereas people just want to find something almost to be offended by.
On your special, it doesn't feel like you're preaching. That's what I think is great. It feels like you're looking on the world going, it's a farce and I'm laughing at everything and just equally enjoying the hypocrisies going on all over the world. And I actually don't mind being self-deprecating as well. It just feels bizarrely, it's really edgy, but it feels like a really comfortable watch. Like you're comfortable in your own skin and you're comfortable with what you're saying. It's, you know, it's nice to that. I've been watching some of your online stuff, your social media stuff actually. And again, I liked your Brexit thing. It just made me laugh that you're telling people to get out of the country now. It's just funny. Why are you doing more of that? Or
I've always done a lot of online stuff. I think the stuff I did online was before even online became. I used to do stuff on Facebook, like put a video up, film it.
I so wanted you to say MySpace then, but anyway.
I think I was on MySpace.
Yes.
Yeah, I was putting probably YouTube videos up on MySpace back in those days, and then when videos became a thing online, I started. I actually used to film little clips and play the videos before the tour shows. So it'd be an intro to that. And then people started doing it online. And I found my online stuff got me a live audience.
Ah.
Yeah, so it was like, fair enough, you're not getting these TV bookings, but I was getting TV viewings on, you know, the figures-wise. It really took off. I remember when I did What's Happening White People 2012, I did one night at the Apollo and a tour. And then in 2014, I started doing all these like Facebook videos, but I started getting trolled. So trolling was quite new in 13, 14. And celebrities really, or people in the media circles really affected, you know, like they were shutting down their accounts. Stephen Fry would turn off his, you know, delete Twitter. I'm offended, I'm turning off my Twitter. And, and then I was thinking, hang on a second, what's going on here? People are really hurt by these trolls, which we were talking about earlier. So people would say, you're this, mate, you're a prick, you're this, that. I think, hang on a second, I'm a comic online, as I am on stage. You don't like what I'm doing. How about we see what we can do with this, turn it around? So what I would do is, I'd then respond to them by making a video about them. So I'd look at their profiles, film their and rip them a new arsehole. And I ended up doing on Facebook maybe 10 million views through a load of videos. Some posts come through the door. Thought that was a troll, just turned up. Hang on a sec, mate. How come you can do my accent? So what I do is make these videos about the trolls and I put them up online. And then I sold three nights at the Hammersmith Apollo and a Brixton Academy off the back of it. The agent couldn't believe it at the time. It's because of all the stuff that happened online. And because I wasn't really on TV, I'd done a second Apollo and, you know, doing stuff like doing one set on Live at the Apollo doesn't tend to do much for comics. You know, I never even presented the show before, but I did and then I ended up getting this bit. But the problem with that was people were turning up at the shows, going, "You're a wanker, mate. You ripped my mate. Take the piss out of him." And I was thinking, no, this is a show. This ain't, we're online now. And then I stopped doing that. I did it a little bit after that, but that brought in a massive crowd. And on the last tour, I did like 100,000 tickets around that figure. So now, without being on TV, it's quite a rare thing to do. I don't think there are many comics who aren't on TV. Maybe a Katie Hopkins, for instance. But that's a very different thing. But I don't even think she couldn't even tour, could she?
She's not got a lot of laughs, has she?
She's got a lot of laughs for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, not a lot of jokes.
I find her quite hilarious, don't you?
I don't take a lot of notice of her, to be honest with you. What I find amusing is how she upsets everyone. It's the same act.
If she had punchlines, man, she'd sell arenas. Yeah. She just need. She's probably got the money for it. I write her punchlines for her. She'd pass it off as irony. And she's...
Celebrities on social media make me laugh because they, you know you're going to go on there, you know you're going to get hammered, if you know, and especially if you say something, and then they're always shocked, and then they reply to the trolls. But you know, it's fine if you reply and do something funny and take it, but you reply going, "Oh, please don't have a go at me," and it's like, yeah, it's like, "Oh, what do you expect?
What do you expect?
Yeah, what out there?"
I wrote this TV idea about, basically, I wrote this idea a while, it didn't get picked up. It's about going to, you know, you meet your troll. You know, but like a lot of kids got bullied, and unfortunately for kids, it's quite a hard thing to deal with. And at schools, and you'd end up hearing about these kids that, you know, end up in bads, you know, kids took their own lives. And I thought this was incredible. Like, let's do something with this. And my idea was, you find this kid who's been trolled, and we end up speaking to the kid's troller, or the troll that trolls the kids, and saying, "Why have you done this?" And finding out the reason behind it. He's a troll, mate, he's just kill him. Like, and that was the idea. But then I ended up seeing something on ITV, BBC 3, I think it was, where this presenter met her troll in the end of the show, and they tracked down this troll. It was just some sad guy who lived in his one-bedroom flat. And she goes, "Well, why are you doing this to me? Why are you trying..." "Something to do, innit?" "Oh, you're famous and I'm not, and..."
"Yeah, but you can't say sexual things to me, can you?"
"But I ain't getting any, am I?" It's like, there's a reason behind it. But I thought, why, instead of saying, "Oh, why, please, not me," bring something to it. Well, I wanted to help kids and find out why. And hopefully, I think that's more serious.
Yeah, but the thing is about trolling, right? And I know this is a cliche thing to say, but it's not about you. It's about the person doing it. It's got nothing to do with the celebrity. When someone says they like you, it's also got nothing to do with you generally.
Exactly.
If it's extreme love or whatever, if it's not. And I remember when I was on Soccer M, so I used to produce Soccer M, so I used to get I used to read all the emails, and obviously it wasn't, the emails didn't come through as much as the stuff which happens now. Every now and then you get the show shit or Lovejoy's a bit of a knobhead. And then one day it really started coming through. Suddenly there was this absolute flood of "Tim Lovejoy's a wanker, Tim Lovejoy's this."
Sorry
Lovejoy's
about that, mate.
Yeah. "Lovejoy's this, Lovejoy's..." And I was like, what's happened there? And it was when Sky TV let you set up an email account on your telly, and, you know, it's this long ago, you could, with your remote control, right, you could suddenly email. So if you're a young man sitting at home, what are you going to do? The first thing you're going to do is go, "Someone's a knob, someone's a wanker, someone's a this, someone's a that." And then it stopped, really, because it's so boring typing an email with your remote control. Yeah. So it lasted like 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. This absolute abuse I got. And then it died down. But it was a precursor to Twitter.
That's the thing is, when it happens to kids, it's bullying. When it happens to adults, it's trolling. It's a slightly different thing. So my aim was to help the kids and say to kids, you're bullying someone here. Because bullying is a massive thing. And it affects. Whereas when it's trolling, the adult does feel like they're being, but why did Stephen Fry close his account down? It's almost giving in to these idiots.
Yeah. Though, on saying that, if you walk down a high street every day and someone says you're a knob, right? Eventually you're going to go, oh, I can't be asked to walk down that high street. Yeah. And so if you are, I mean, the thing for me was just stop tweeting as much, and then it all sort of slowly died and never reply to them. And for, that was what I was doing. But as a comic, I think half the time you've got to do a bit
feed
of that.
Feed the trolls, they say. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's part and parcel of part and parcel of your job. The ones which really get me the most are journalists, right? So journalists come along and they've got to fill out their, I used to write a column once and I gave up after a while. Because the editor kept saying, Tim, it's not black and white enough. You know, I was worrying about football. You've got to say, sack the manager. I said, well, I don't want to say that. And I said, life isn't black and white, it's grey.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, but that doesn't get clicks. It was an online column. And so what happens with the columnists is they sit there and they go, Christ, I've got to write an article. Mm. Okay, right. I'll tell you what, I'll talk about Paul Chowdhury, right? I've gone to reviews column. He's not funny. He's a knob. He shouldn't be on TV or something. And they're the ones who are really bad. Like, so I got a whole half page spread on me once about why I shouldn't get Match of the Day 2. Mm. And I wasn't even up for the job. And I read it and I remember thinking, God, this is so miserable. The guy absolutely annihilated me and said how I was the worst thing for football and everything else. Latterly, I look back and I think, that's really impressive that he could be bothered to write half a page on me, and also that his editor went, yeah, we'll have half a page on Lovejoy. That's good, you know, that's good fodder. But the journalists don't realise they're trolling all the celebrities when they're doing that, or whoever they're talking about.
It's considered criticism.
Yeah, critics are trolls.
Critics are basically
trolls.
Paid trolls.
Yeah.
If you think about it, there's about two critics that. One went out to get me really badly, and the last one I was called a xenophobe. I talk about this in the show, a xenophobe, a homophobe, everything. But jokes were taken well out of context. Whereas if I was a racist, could I play to the diverse audience I play to? Unless I was the new Bernard Manning, for instance.
Yeah.
And there's another critic, which I won't name to give him the publicity he wants, has been reviewing me badly since 2005.
Yeah.
Does it then become trolling? When you still review me?
Well, one of my friends was a TV reviewer. Well, I say a friend. He was a friend. Mm. I kind of knew him quite well. I helped set him up with his girlfriend a while back and something. And then, well, I did a David Beckham documentary. And he absolutely hammered me. And everybody else said it was nice. This was years ago. And when I saw him, I said, why'd you hammer me? He goes, because that's what my audience want. They don't want me to be nice about you, do they? Yeah. And I thought, now you look back, you could just go, yeah, you're a troll. You're making a career out of hammering everybody, you know, even your mates. Mm. And I thought, and I don't hate them for it because people want to read it. People like hate. We've created that environment. However, I wouldn't want to be that person who did that.
Yeah, but also you're producing a TV show. Probably not a bad fee. Whereas he's getting 80 quid to write a column on you. There are other agendas attached which we don't read into.
Yes.
And he's your mate and he's seen you shoot up there, become the legendary Tim Lovejoy. And he's...
I like that tag. Put it on the box. Yeah. Whatever box it is, put it on it.
Whereas, you know, the critics, it's a weird one. When I find the biggest critics and the most important critics are your audience.
Does it get you down when someone says something nasty about it? It used to get me really down.
Online or
a critic, someone like that.
It used to really depress me. Yeah, I was thinking, hang on a second. There were certain people, and when I was doing what I was doing back then, it probably did stop me from getting certain bookings on, you know, certain mainstream TV shows, and I was seen as some kind of a right-wing extreme comedian. But if you watch my show now, I'm not that kind of person, and I never want to defend my jokes. I never want to go out and say, hang on a second, let me just break down this review on me, you know, because it just defeats the whole object of comedy. So I want my audience to decide. And my following has been very organic and it's been very word of mouth, which I find the most rewarding, rather than, oh, let's go and watch that guy off the TV. Whereas when you do a TV set, oh, let's go and watch him. You'd be seeing him on, you know, Mock the Week or Have I Got Something For You or something like that. And
you think,
well, they're intrigued. He's the guy off the telly. Whereas I'm the comic. I'm not the guy off a certain show. I'm just the comedian that they've seen. And I've built up this audience for over 20 years.
Yeah. I like your take on feeling low or depression on your special, where you say Indian people don't have depression. If you get depression, we just get rid of them. it's really funny that.
See, yeah. Now people would get offended by that. You know, mental health is a very serious thing to joke about. I'll talk about some deep things, and I'm not going to do that because I'm not going to do it justice here. Yeah. But even mental health, I was talking about in 2017, 16, when I started writing it. Now it's quite you almost have to come out as depressed to sell an album.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a thing back then.
I'll tell you what it is. It's a way of defending yourself. If you ever do anything bad, just go, I've got mental health issues.
Mental health issues.
You get away with it.
Yeah. 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 You troll me for, mate. Mental health issues, mate. I wasn't feeling too good at the time. And I talk about the diverse... Yeah, as you say, the different how different communities deal with mental health issues, and how it's almost a new thing. But you go to the gym, you work on your body. We not work on our minds. You never say, "What we're doing today? Let's meet up, Tim, and just relieve some of our stresses in our minds.
Meditate.
Let's do a session together, yeah. A mind session." You don't do that. We'll go to the gym and work on our abs.
Yeah.
Let's do what we're doing today. Let's do chest or legs. We never say let's do brain. Brain today. No one does that, do they? We don't work on our minds the same way and relieve our thoughts. And we just keep it pent up until it blows up in our own minds. And then you hit some kind of a slump, which is, as I was talking about in the Movember podcast, when you have massive highs and massive lows is I think, the issue. Whereas try and find a positive and negative to everything. And you'll try and surf through life without going through these massive emotional reactions, which we all suffer from.
Yeah, I think it's becoming aware of your emotions and realizing they're going to pass. Even the worst things, like, you know, that everyone who listens to this podcast is well aware that my brother died, which is a horrific thing to go through. I know you've had death in your family as well, but it's such a horrible feeling, but it does pass eventually. You don't ever forget them. It never feels less sad. However, that horrible feeling you have it sitting right there in your stomach does pass eventually.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing because, you know, grief and mourning, we see it as life goes on, that's kind of, and one day our time will come. And sometimes that's the easiest way to deal with it. That will be there one day. And, you know, sometimes you think, what will happen if I die? Who's going to turn up to my funeral? I'm going to be I'm the man that day. You know, some of us think, oh, you know, you better be at my funeral, mate. Or what music? Everyone asks, what are you going to play? What's the song you're going to play at your funeral and stuff? And you better cry at my funeral and all that stuff. Hope you'll be upset. But then you think, yeah, people will be upset for maybe a day or how long. But life goes on, and people will deal with it or think back on it. But If I die, you know, I leave a legacy behind in my material, but that's it. And then everyone else's time will come. But the point is, how do we deal with that pain as you've dealt with, but you remember your brother in a fond way and you try and remember the good things?
Yeah, as I did an article for Marie Curie the other day on death, actually, which is coming out very soon. It made me think about it again. And the one thing the journalist got out of me, which was really good, is the death of my brother has really changed my life, in the fact that I think about death now. Whereas before my brother died, I just was immortal. Like every young man, I was like, oh, I can do whatever I want. I'm never going to die. I've got to, you know, I'll live till 100 or whatever. And so it's really questioned death to me. And then I always think, when I'm lying on my deathbed, what am I going to care about? Mm-hmm. You know, am I going to care about a car? No, or... So it's only about relationships. It's about my kids and stuff like that. And so it's, you know, it's trying to get a grip of that. And every time I feel miserable, you know, we're all the same, where we go, I can't believe they got that job and I didn't.
Yeah,
so you're on your deathbed, I don't care that I didn't get
Who cares that I didn't get the one show?
The Masked Singer. Yeah. Whatever. I'd love to do one of those Saturday night TV shows. I just think I'd just in a shiny suit. I'd be so wrong for it. That's why I want to do it.
Yeah. And I think you'd be good for that, actually.
Turn up.
But you can do day morning shows, which is probably more difficult than doing evening shows.
Oh, I just turn up and chat crap, don't I?
Yeah, but it's the perception of you is clean cut Tim Lovejoy. They don't know the Tim Lovejoy I know. Yeah.
All right. We've got to just talk about your acting. Because you've been doing quite a bit of acting recently. You've been in out in Italy last year.
Yeah.
Filming for, what was it, Sky Italia?
Yeah, Devils.
Devils.
With Patrick Dempsey. It's a 10-part, one-hour drama about the banking crisis. And I play one of the regulars in that. So that's coming out soon.
All in Italian?
It was completely 100% English. I could barely speak Italian. And I think some of it might be, you know, subtitled, but the main character's an Italian banker. It's based on a true story. And Patrick Dempsey is the selling point there from Grey's Anatomy. So very different. When you're on set for 6 months, you really miss the stand-up. It's a very different experience, acting.
I'm really glad you said that, because I hate comics who, I don't hate them, sorry, but I like my comics to love doing stand-up. I don't like it when they go, I'm only doing stand-up so I can end up getting my own TV show somewhere. I like the ones who go, I can't wait to get back and do a bit of stand-up. And all the greats always can't resist getting back on the stage again.
I get depressed when I'm not on stage for too long. Okay. I need to, if I'm not on stage, I'll go up to a little comedy club and I'll try out some stuff because it's keeping that muscle working.
Yeah.
It's that comedy muscle. Like Eddie Murphy has been rumored to make this comeback, this $100 million comeback. And he's going to be amazing. Yeah, he was great when he did Delirious and Raw. And he was 22 and then he was 26 on those two specials. He's in his mid-50s now. He spent more time outside of stand-up than he has in his life than in stand-up. So he spent his early teens to that 26, 20, until he started doing major movies. When you're out for that long and you haven't been working on that muscle, how good are you going to be? Yeah, they're going to work on it. They're going to make sure he's a box office smash, a legendary comedian. But it's going to be quite interesting to see how that comeback goes. But everyone's, oh my God, it's going to be amazing, isn't it? He hasn't been in the gym for most of his life. He's been great at doing Shrek and Disney films and other things, but he hasn't. Even him going to the clubs, walking on stage, people will go nuts. How is he going to gauge that material if it's real or not? You know, when you're a superstar and you walk on stage, it's very difficult to gauge hardcore material.
He says something brilliant about turning up to a club. And you know that you look out and you go, this audience, they're just not, they don't know me. They're not going to get me. I've got to win this audience.
You've got to win him over, yeah.
Do you get that buzz out doing
that? Yeah, you get, you know, Eddie Murphy could never do that. He couldn't walk on stage anywhere on the planet. And just think, I'm going to just see if this works or not. He's a superstar.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm a nobody.
He sells out Wembley Arena, yeah. So that's not bad. Yeah. Are you a good actor?
Am I good at acting?
Yeah, you're a good actor.
I mean, I got that. That was, I cast that. Well, I did the casting with Nick Horan, who directed half of that series, who did Sherlock and Doctor Who. So I thought he was a good indicator of whether someone can act or not. Whereas, am I a good actor? I do go up for certain big films, which I can't even say because every time I go up for them, I have to sign an NDA these days.
Right.
So nowadays, which is, if you don't, been listening, is a non-disclosure agreement. Which R. Kelly used to get. The girls, do you know that? He used to get them to sign an NDA.
What were the girls?
Yeah, as soon as he met them, they'd have to sign an NDA, but now they've considered invalid. If you commit a crime, they're now being overridden. So certain big celebrities would get people, all these groupies, and get them to sign NDAs, which is highly... It's just disgusting, isn't it, if you think about it?
So before we get into the questions I ask everybody, is acting, is this it? Are we going to see you? Are you going to have an acting career? Do we?
See, that's the thing about stand-up. Well,
you've got an acting career, sorry. Are you going to be doing more of this?
Continue acting.
Yeah, are you going to try and go? Are you going to America to act?
You can do acting and get the biggest job tomorrow, and then the next week you'll be working in Starbucks. So that's the thing about... Whereas stand-up, unless you end up doing something really stupid... You have an audience. I think the audience decide if you're funny or not. Whereas acting, it's an opinion of a director or a casting director. It's very fickle, isn't it? Mm. It's a stand-up, I find, so much more real. And the comedy I do now, it has come from a place of honesty and the truth. I want to hopefully get to that point in my career where...
Why did Amazon give you a special? Because obviously the great places put specials are Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff like that. And as you say, they're not giving you the TV show. I'm so glad they did because it's brilliant. But it's... What was their... You know.
Well, it was nice to get offers from. So I'm not going to go. I can't say who I got offers from, but it was nice to have a choice. So, why did Amazon give it to me?
But do they look at the tickets you sold them? Because I assume they just go. Always they go. I don't know. Mickey Flanagan. Oh, he's on TV all the time. He's not anymore, but he was. You know, he's on TV time. Or Jack Whitehall. He's on TV all the time. So let's give him a special because he can sell out Wembley or do whatever. Well, you know, if you're not getting the one show, why did they go? Yeah, let's, I mean, it's great they have, but
I didn't ask them. I might call them and say, "Why did you give me the show? Have you seen me, mate? Have you seen my act? What did you give it to me for?" But at the time, they were going into that arena of specials, and I was the first batch of British stand-up specials, and they did it with the Americans at the time, and they have a bigger platform. Netflix is great, but it's when it comes to Amazon, I think they're in more territories.
I don't know. It's absolutely fantastic. And
the good thing about Amazon is if you want to order the special, which I can also deliver it within an hour, same day delivery.
Right, let me ask you the questions that I ask all my guests. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
What one piece of advice would I give my... See, this is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I think live your dream and be yourself in life. Not many people, as we were saying earlier, that you were doing account, you were a mortgage broker, but you went into presenting, is you've lived your dream, but most people don't. They want security and stuff, but I think just go for it in life. And people say, oh, it's easy for you to say, mate, you've done it, but... There was a point when I hadn't done it.
Yeah, I always say that. I mean, like, I don't want to say I'm brilliant because I'm clearly not, but it's like, you know, I had a normal education, didn't get much, got a few O-levels and stuff, you know, went to a state school and stuff. But at some stage in my life, I went, holy crap, I can't keep doing this. And I've got to do something. So I tried really hard and I was lucky, right time, right place for what I wanted to do. But there was a lot of sadness, a lot of, you know, loneliness and self-doubt.
Well, you have been skint for a while, unless you came from a very well-off family.
Yeah, skint. It's, I keep on saying to my kids, you know, they keep going on about degrees and everything else. I said, that's great, and you should go to university and do that, but try and find a passion.
In life, yeah.
Because if you find something you love, a passion, then hopefully the work will come from that. It's a good idea.
My advice in life would then be, live a life you want. Don't live the dream. I mean, it's hard to do a job that you dream about doing. Just try it. Unless you haven't tried, if you didn't try doing presenting and you thought, now your mortgage broker, I'll come and ask you for a mortgage, you know, you're Paul Chowdhury, mate. I'm seeing your special.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say you're the legendary Tim Lovejoy.
Put that on a box somewhere. I'd say, put it on a box.
I just come out of a meeting with Tim Lovejoy, my mortgage broker.
I wasn't very good. I didn't like that job. Right, what's something you think people should know?
I think I used to judge people certainly on the way you see them at the start, but I think people are everything. People are very complex and have every trait. I think people are good or bad. I think people are good and bad and sad and happy, and everyone has every different trait. I've got quite a grumpy I've got a straight face. I come across as quite serious. People think this guy is serious and is a grumpy bastard. But that's if you look at me on the surface. Don't judge a book by its cover, unless it's, you know, a holy book or something. But you have to see people for the complexities of them, rather than just that guy's a wanker or that guy's a good bloke, mate. No, he's probably not a good bloke. He's probably got every other trait as well.
Yeah. Is there something you've changed your mind about?
Something I changed my mind about, I'd say... Don't judge people due to their political views as well. I think that's another thing, this whole Brexit thing. People who voted Brexit or out are racists when there's such a more complex debate than that. Like, If you voted Conservative or Brexit, mate, unfriend me. And you see this stuff on Facebook and think, what? You just automatically assume that people come from different backgrounds. Racism is a different thing. People think, you know, this whole thing when I was growing up, my family were coming over here stealing people's jobs, for instance, and I was nicking people's jobs. But when you're living in a working class area and it's hard to live in these areas and people are trying to get what they can, people are at blame. It's a classist system, I think, in this country. We live in a very classist society in England, and people are judged for what they're going through a lot when we're not looking at the bigger picture.
That's great advice. Do you get racism in online, and do you get racism in real life?
I don't get as much racism in real life anymore, apart from when, you know, when I was doing clubs, I was getting racist heckles, for instance. That's almost unheard of now, because it's a crime to use certain words that would be considered racial hatred. That's not a thing anymore. If you say that in part, you can get arrested, when that wasn't a thing. It was almost a punchline to a joke in a sitcom when I was growing up, which is why it's acceptable to use these words and for Spike Milligan to brown up, for instance. It'd be unheard of these days. But then it was done in Little Britain. But even Matt Lucas said he apologizes for someone who wouldn't do the route. And that wasn't too long ago, Little Britain stuff. But they were browning up.
You hear Chris Kamara, he's been on our podcast, talk about this stuff. The punchlines, you're right, and the sitcoms, it's horrific.
And we were supposed to laugh at it. But then
at the time, I suppose people didn't think it was, even though it is. You know, I suppose it's all in context.
It's societal, isn't it?
Yeah.
So comedy reflects societal change.
Yeah.
And evolution within constructs of, as we put it, society.
So someone said to me, someone said on this podcast not so long ago, it's slightly different, but Dr. Susie Gage said that she never thought in her lifetime that cannabis would be legalized. However, in Gavin and Stacey, the mum and dad, not even Gavin and Stacey, were smoking a joint and getting high, which reflects, if you can put that in a sitcom, it reflects what society is thinking about cannabis. People are going, we don't care about it anymore. Yeah. So it's going to be either decriminalized or legalized, I imagine, very soon. What about online? Do you get racism online?
The thing about online is people can get away with anything. Racism, sexism, homophobia, everything. You see a comment and you see some of the stuff said to me. You think, if you said this in real life, you'd immediately get arrested. And I've had police turn up to my house twice for death threats online. And on the second occasion, they looked for the guy's account, but said, we can't do much because he can just say his account was hacked or someone else was using his account. So it was almost as if you can't do much even about death threats. And then said, well, just let us know if he turns up at your house, give us just call up or call 999. I said, it's a bit late if he turns up at my house when he's standing there with a weapon. I think it's a bit late by then. It's either me or him. One of us is going to survive.
Yeah.
So it's a very grey area. I've had stuff happen in the streets where, you know, certain incidences have happened and people have been spoken to by the police. Yeah, it does happen. It still does happen. And these are off the back of jokes or jokes that are misconstrued.
Really?
Or people just think, he's that guy. He's that guy we've seen online. But when people see someone in the flesh, it's very different to when they're seeing you online. They almost can't believe it.
I've never had much hassle in real life, if I'm honest with you. Just every now and then you get somebody who doesn't know how to react to you because, you know, like you see your mate in the street, or kids do, you're a teenager, you see your mate in the street, rather than going, all right, John, you go, wanker! You do the wanker, you know how people do that. And sometimes you get that reaction with people in the street, Lovejoy, are you wanker? They don't want to go, I like you or whatever. So they don't know what to say. So I get sometimes that, but.
Yeah, I get it. Here's the bastard. Hello, bastard. I was in Dubai in some nightclub. This girl was going, you are the bastard. You are a bastard. I was thinking, shut the fuck.
That's from the special, by the way he speaks on the special stuff.
Also, I had another thing in Carnaby Street last year. I was walking down Carnaby Street. Yeah. This bloke stood there. He started smiling. And he was just stood there smiling. As I walked past him, he kept on smiling. And I just continued to walk. I went home. I went onto Twitter. He said, "Hi, Paul. I just saw you on Carnaby Street. I stood there and smiled at you. You didn't say hello to me. I'm no longer a fan.
Yeah.
You're really arrogant. I'm unfollowing you. How do I know you're smiling at me? Hang on a second. Are you smiling at me, Paul Chowdhury, the comedian? That would show how arrogant I was to think he stood there looking at me, thinking, just say hello, mate. Well, say hey, man. Like, just that's it.
Do you get more recognised now you've got the beard and moustache going?
Well, I actually grew the beard and moustache to not get recognised. Now people know me for the beard and moustache. It's time to get rid of the beard and moustache.
I love it, though. I love it. It's a really good look, isn't it?
Or get rid of the beard and keep the moustache.
Yeah, it's strong. It's strong. Where did we get to? So something you changed your mind about. We did that, didn't we? Any life hacks?
Any life hacks?
Mm.
I say instead of drinking coffee in the morning, which people do, I drink a litre of water with a lemon in it. I think that's quite important.
Why?
I think I was talking to a dermatologist about this, and she was saying how it's very good for your skin rather than coffee dehydrates your skin straight away.
Your skin does look good, Paul.
And I'm 72. So we're the same age, mate.
Yeah, whatever. Can you recommend the book?
How to Win Friends and Influence People. You remember that book
in
the 1930s?
Yeah.
Dale Carnegie.
Yeah.
I was reading it recently, and I was thinking, most self-help books, in fact, probably all self-help, and what the world sees as self-help or positive thinking comes from this book. And it's how, it's not manipulating people, but a lot of people think networking, for instance, is a manipulation of people, when it's not. It's just being normal with people. Like, we've kind of almost become mates to a certain degree by speaking to each other, but we wouldn't have had that connection on just speaking to you off the Sunday brunch.
Yeah.
Now, speaking to you off that, I had a very different perception as to who you were as to when I met you. I didn't think you were a good bloke. Now,
well, I'm glad it's that way around, not the other way around.
It could have gone the other way.
Yeah, it could have. I always say, look crap in your publicity pictures, because when people meet you, they go, oh, you look so much better in real life, whereas you look great in your publicity pictures.
Yeah. Photoshop, mate.
Bit of a filter. Disappointment. What's it like being famous?
I never really see myself as famous, because being famous, people think you're on TV, but then people say you're a celebrity. What is a celebrity these days? When I was growing up, right, you had to be on TV, you had to get an equity card. And to get an equity card, you need to be on 3 jobs on TV. Like, and then I had to do extra work to get an equity card. Now, what killed off equity to a certain degree, they're not as big as they were as a powerful acting union, was reality shows. Reality stars didn't need an equity card anymore. And things like Big Brother kill that off. So I do have an equity card. I don't think I've renewed it in years. But am I famous or a celebrity now, when everyone is?
What's really interesting is going to the NTA's National Television Awards and the TV Choice Awards this year, I realized that people on TV are no longer famous, like actors and comedy, unless you're Anton Deck or someone like that, one of the huge ones, Graham Norton. The reality stars are the famous ones now. They're the celebrity. And if I was to walk down a red carpet now, like years ago, I'd have had a few like, all right, Tim's. Now it's like completely, who gives a shit about Tim? There's a reality star there. However, the reality stars, they have a very short shelf
exactly.
life.
Exactly. How long have they got?
Yeah, a couple of years, maybe.
See,
and
those guys are around for a couple of years. You're like an alligator. You're always scaly. Scaly.
Yes,
scaly, rugged.
Yeah.
You're going to be around for thousands of years.
Cold-blooded, yeah.
You've lived through the Ice Age. You're still here.
That's why I like, I tell you, the one I like is Rylan. Because he's worked really hard. I mean, he's on every TV show in the world at the moment. He's brought back Supermarket Sweep, and he's doing every spin-off, and he's doing that. But good luck to him. And he's worked hard, and he's got the gig, and he's thought, and he's really dug in and worked very hard at it. And I think he's bringing back Ready, Steady, Cook at the moment. And I really like him when he comes on the show and stuff. I like him. Whereas some of the others are just like, right, I'm famous now, give me some work.
Yeah.
He's actually worked at what he's done. And that's what you've got to do. When you're given the opportunity, like the reality stars, you've got to really work.
Well, you know, this is the whole thing about it with mental health issues, that a lot of them end up not doing anything afterwards and then they end up back in, not a supermarket sweep, but working in a supermarket. So whereas he's ended up on the other side of it, a lot of them end up not knowing what to do. They're not recognized anymore. They've got millions of followers online, but they can't do anything with it. What do you do with this? I'd rather have 100,000 followers that are into my stuff rather than a million followers that don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah,
I can't sell tickets to a million people that don't know what I'm doing. So I'm not this massive online TV star even, but I managed to sell live tickets, and I sold that through the live arena, live spectrum, going up and down the country for years on end, making people trust spending an evening with me, which is more valuable than he's the guy off Love Island. Mm. But if you're watching Love Island, you know, I could do the next series.
Celebrity Love Island.
I'm probably too old and too ugly for Love Island.
Final question, Paul. What is the meaning of life?
What's the meaning of life? It's, is there a meaning to life? It's finding things to do. What do we do in life, really? Is we just do stuff.
Yeah.
Even when you're getting paid to do stuff, we're just doing stuff. Mm. Doing things, even doing this now is fine. Doing what would I be doing other than doing this? You know, probably something more interesting. But is we're all doing stuff, even stuff in life, as we were talking about. If you're going to be a mortgage broker or you're going to do stuff, you're doing stuff, and the whole point is finding stuff to do.
I like this. That, I really like this.
That you get paid to do. Find something you're interested in doing, but get paid for it. I think that's probably the more.
I love this because everybody says be kind, be loving or something like that. You're like, find stuff to do.
Yeah. Do something. I think that revolves.
It's the best meaning of life I think we've had. I think it's up there. It's got to be one of the best. Suggs's one piece of advice was my favourite. Always go to the toilet before you leave a pub. Even if you don't feel like you need one, always go.
Before you leave a pub?
Yeah, before you leave a pub, always go to the toilet. Even if you feel like you don't need to go, always make sure you go to the toilet before you leave
the pub. This reminds me of that. Yeah, I don't like to use toilets in pubs.
Why?
Just they're all like toilets and train spotting. You've seen the state of some of these toilets.
Oh, terrible, yeah. But I mean, it's
a real pub.
Yeah, but you'd like, you know, just go for a wee, it's fine. It's like
if you go for a wee, it's fine. But
those
toilets,
mate,
you do not want to, you want to hover around them. Like Back to the Future.
Paul, thank you so much for doing the podcast today. What have you got coming up? Anything you need? Where's the best place for people to follow you at the moment? Instagram?
I'm on, as with most Z-list celebrities. I'm on everything. Twitter. The thing I don't like about these online platforms is you could click like on one of my pages, but you won't see most of the stuff I do unless you click notifications on. Do you know that?
Yeah.
So I've got like 360,000 followers on, say, Facebook, but you put a thing out and you'll be lucky to get 100 likes because they don't see it.
Yeah.
And then it says paid to boost your reach of your post. Because they want you to pay to reach your own audience now. It's not like having a mailing list.
They're not stupid. They're they worked out that we were all making we were making money and they weren't. So
they weren't,
all the social media they don't see your, unless you pay, they don't see your posts on Facebook or Instagram or anywhere.
And then now they own
But what WhatsApp. They do is they push political agenda because if you're right wing or left wing, they'll push that at you because that makes you engage because it makes you angry.
Or if you talk about a toaster to me, they'll give you an advert for a toaster in a minute.
They will, yeah, they will. Have you got anything coming up? Any gig specials? Any TV things?
Just gonna try and write some new stuff and announce some dates soon. I'm working on all this new stuff at the moment. It's all going around in my head. You just reminded me of toilets and pubs. I had a big routine on using a toilet in someone's house, which is another offensive thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, when someone just turns up and takes a shit in your house, you're taking the shit home, mate. Don't come to my house and take it. That's probably why you got a downstairs toilet, which I have as well.
Yeah.
Always have a toilet for the guests.
Yeah. Always.
Don't you find it offensive when they use your toilet?
Upstairs, yeah.
Never let them up there.
Don't let people sitting on my one, yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Paul, thank you so much for doing the podcast and hopefully we'll see you
anytime,
soon.
Anytime, Tim. Anytime.
Yeah, oh, I've got to come for that meal with you as well.
Yeah, we've got to go out for that Indian.
Vegetarian curry.
Yeah.
Perfect. Love it. Paul Chowdhury there. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation with him. Must go for vegetarian Indian with him. Really looking forward to that as well. Do you think he'll pay?
No, I think that's up to you, mate. You're the TV. If, I mean, if he can't get on the one show, then I loved how that kept coming up.
Oh, that's funny, isn't it?
I love a runner, like a running joke, and
what I liked about
it became bigger than the thing it was. He probably just went, "Oh, no, I didn't get it," and then it just kept coming back.
What I like about Paul is the little sparkle in his eyes when he talks about stand up. As I said on the podcast, I do like the comedians who like doing that, because that's gotta be the hardest thing in the world, to stand up on a stage and basically put material out there and make people laugh. Easier if you've got a guitar in front of you, I suppose, or something you can distract yourself with. But if it's just you and words and you're there, wow. I mean, that's tough on your own, just standing up there. And hats off to anyone who does it. I don't think I could ever envisage doing that for a career.
Me, absolutely not either. No, no.
But I imagine it must be one of the best feelings in the world when you stand up and do that. The comedian that they all say is the greatest is Richard Pryor, don't they? He mentioned Eddie Murphy there. He's one of the great. Steve Martin, his act was incredible back in the day. It's funny because stand-ups come and go, don't they? Those great big comedy specials come and go. The Mickey Flanagan one, have you seen those? They're actually really good.
And I
do like listening to, tuning into one of those stand-up specials when they go wrong. There's plenty out there I've watched where I'm like, a load of those American ones hit Netflix and you go, this looks good. You're about 5 minutes in going, Jesus Christ, this is appalling. But they're doing it.
Yeah.
And I can't do it.
No, exactly.
So I feel so
guilty. Only so critical you can be, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't be critical of someone who can be asked to stand up there on a stage, just you and a microphone and try and make people laugh. One of the toughest jobs you can do.
In show
business.
Come on, now let's give some other people some credit.
But let's think about it, though. Even in every walk of life, public speaking's not easy.
No.
And you're going to throw yourself up there in front of everyone. So, I know what you're saying. Like, they're not digging holes in roads and they're not sort of, saving lives. However, it's tough because they're being judged. And no more so you've been.
No, fair point.
That is the biggest thing you're ever going to get judged on when you stand up and do public speaking, especially if you've got to try and make people laugh. I've watched plenty of people bomb, I tell you, especially at award ceremonies and stuff. I always think when people come out, sometimes people ask me, Mark, they say, do you want to come and give an award away? I go, how long do we have to do it? And they go, it's a really quick one. All you're allowed to do is come out and then
just
read the nominations. We've got no time for you to do anything. I go, yeah, all right, I'll do it. If they go, it's just a little fill for 30 seconds. Nah, I'm all right.
No,
30 seconds, that's plenty of time to die. No, I'm all right. I don't want to do that. This podcast is sponsored by the lovely people at Cooker.
Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker and instantly make a brew. Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker. Hot water for vegetables too.
Yeah, boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love it. It does your normal hot water, your normal cold water. It does 100 degree boiling hot water. Turn of a tap, push it. It's the push and turn, and then it comes out. And you've got your chilled filtered water and your chilled sparkling filtered water as well. I absolutely love this. And as I say, I always say this, thank you so much for sponsoring the podcast. It really helps us. And also, it's a great product. So it's fantastic that we have something that we love who sponsors our podcast.
And it usually gives you a reason to... belittle me as well, does it, by saying it's so simple even Mark can use it.
It's so simple even Mark can
there
use it.
See, it's
it's attractive, it looks good. I can't imagine life without it. I can't imagine. God, it's been such a long time since I had a kettle. What are they? A kettle. It's like when people mangled clothes years ago That's what a kettle's like, you know.
Funnily enough, I was thinking about that the other day.
What, mangling clothes?
You know, when you had to, yeah, you had to put it on a mangle and rub it up and down.
That's not a mangle. I thought the mangle was the...
Oh,
the,
yeah, that's right. No, what's that? That's the
washboard. I don't know, the washboard. Yeah, that's the washboard.
Where's my washboard?
Stroke musical instrument.
Yes.
Yeah, and then your mangle. Anyway, thanks, lovely people at Quikr for sponsoring this podcast. That's it for this week. We'll see you all very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye!
Thank you for listening to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Mark Augustin. If you would like to contact us, then our email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.